Today is Wednesday, May 13th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a historic standoff as the U.S. Supreme Court weighs whether the president's tax return should be made public.
Every president voluntarily turned over his tax return. So it gets to be a pitched battle here because President Trump is the first one to refuse to do that.
The top U.S. health official warns cities and states about reopening too fast.
There is a real risk that you will trigger an outbreak that you may not be able to control.
Also ahead, if you test positive for the COVID-19 antibody, are you immune from getting reinfected? It's all on today's International Edition. The top U.S. infectious disease expert warned Congress Tuesday that if the country reopens too soon during the pandemic, it will bring needless suffering and death and set back any economic gains. Dr. Anthony Fauci was among a number of experts testifying before a Senate panel.
It would almost turn the clock back rather than going forward.
Joining us to talk more about the hearing is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, what can you tell us?
Well, I think what was interesting about this hearing was just from the way it looked and appeared on TV is the fact that Dr. Fauci and a lot of the nation's other top health experts were not even on Capitol Hill for this hearing because, of course, they were exposed to the coronavirus in the White House and had to kind of do this partial self-quarantine and appear in the hearing via video conferencing. Then when you talk about the room itself, the hearing room, it was really interesting to see how many people were wearing masks, how many people were not wearing masks, and how that really broke down by party affiliation, which really speaks to the way that this is developing into a political debate here in the United States. This whole issue of balancing reopening the country, restarting the American economy, with concerns that if we do that too quickly, we may have more coronavirus hotspots around the country. And that's exactly what Dr. Fauci warned lawmakers about in his testimony.
A big issue from the beginning has been not enough testing. And that's, I think, what health officials have been concerned about. Without testing, we don't know who may be have been exposed. What did they say about that?
Right. So we really got some clarity out of the hearing when one of the health experts from the Health and Human Services Agency said that the U.S. would have the ability to conduct about 40 to 50 million tests per day by September. He was touting that as really something that would be an encouraging number for the U.S. to get back up and running. Of course, the question is, will that be enough at that point, particularly if we're facing a second wave of the pandemic going into the fall?
And there was a pretty stark warning from Dr. Anthony Fauci about opening too soon.
That's absolutely right. He kind of laid out this series of checkpoints that each area around the nation needs to clear before they move on to the next step in the reopening process. And he warned very sternly that if that area goes past that checkpoint too quickly, namely that first key checkpoint, which is a decrease in deaths from the virus in a 14-day period.
That's VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Well, if you've had COVID-19, are you immune from getting it again? That is a question many people are asking as governments start to lift restrictions. Some nations are even considering visitors provide immunity passports. But viruses can vary greatly, and there's still a lot of unknown about this novel coronavirus. Joining us now to understand how people can know if they've developed immunity is Dr. Sanjaya Senanayake, an infectious disease physician and associate professor of medicine at the Australian National University. Thank you so much for being with us, doctor. Is there any evidence yet that people who have had COVID-19 are immune from getting reinfected?
Well, they can't be sure that getting COVID-19 gives everyone who's had it immunity. So that is not certain at the moment. The World Health Organization has recently come out with a statement saying that as well. The problem is that this outbreak hasn't been around long enough, even though it seems like it's been going on for an eternity. It doesn't seem like it's been going on for long enough to test that hypothesis. So we will get to know that in time, but now we can only speculate. We have some data showing that some people who are infected with COVID-19 get a strong immune response. And in one of our medical institutes in Australia, the Doherty Institute, they looked at a fairly young person who had a mild case of COVID-19 and monitored their immune response, different aspects of the immune system, including antibodies, and found they had a good response. But the World Health Organization, in their statement, they looked at a number of studies that have come out so far that have looked at what we call neutralizing antibodies. And when we say a neutralizing antibody, we mean that an antibody that stops a virus from infecting a human cell. They only found that some people had neutralizing antibodies and not all at very high levels. So that is of concern.
If you could explain what an antibody is.
When our immune system encounters a new infection, it needs to get a specific immune response to that infection. That's called the adaptive immunity. Now, while that adaptive immunity can take a few days to get running, so we've got an inbuilt immune response called the innate immune response, which is just sort of a general immune response that attacks any kind of infection. And while that innate immune response is going on, other aspects of the immune system are producing antibodies. These are proteins that recognize certain parts of a virus or a bacterium and will stop them from propagating infection. At least the ones that are neutralizing will do that. Every time we're infected with a virus, we get some sort of antibody response.
Some viruses that we're more familiar with come back and you can get them in a mutated form, like, say, the flu. Is it true that there's a possibility that this could be one like, say, the measles, that if you've had it, you won't get it again?
So that's a good point. We have some infections that we never get again, such as measles, but others which we do get again, which you've nicely illustrated with influenza, also tetanus, even if you've had natural infection. And a lot of that relates to the neutralizing antibodies, which stop the pathogen from entering a human cell. So we don't know whether this coronavirus is like that or not. Can we look at other coronaviruses to get that answer? Well, if we look at SARS, we know that people who've had SARS did develop quite a strong immune response. Maybe not everyone, but a lot of people, suggesting you get some sort of immunity. There are also four coronaviruses that have been circulating amongst humanity for the last few decades that cause about 20% of the common cold. We do know that you do get an immune response to that, but the immune response to those coronaviruses only seem to last for a short period. So antibody levels in one experiment, sort of 1 year after infection, were already starting to fall. So the authors postulated those coronaviruses, infection only would give you about 2 to 3 years protection before you were susceptible again. All the positive antibody blood tests tells us at the moment is that someone has had COVID-19 infection. We can't necessarily generalize it or extrapolate it to definitively say much more. Mm-hmm. As you say, even if it is an antibody that we think is a neutralizing antibody protein, which we think is going to be a neutralizing antibody that should stop the coronavirus from entering a cell, we don't know for sure that that is the case. And even if someone's positive, we don't know if the levels are high enough to do the job effectively and protect them from a second infection. Having said that, with time, we will know. When we see more and more infections and we get a sense of whether people are being infected or not, then we will be able to say, yes, this particular antibody test being positive means you do have protection. But right now, we can't say that.
So would you say it's not really going to be helpful for people to get an antibody test if they have not been sick?
There is a benefit at a community level and an epidemiological level to try and understand how this virus has been spreading throughout a community. It would be useful to do what we call sero surveys of communities and take blood and see who's antibody positive, who's had the infection before.
Dr. Sanjaya Senanyake, infectious disease physician and associate professor of medicine at the Australian National University. The global COVID-19 pandemic continues to hit the United States very hard. More than 80,000 Americans have died. But through it all, health care workers have continued to work around the clock to stem the tide, usually at great risk to themselves. In the second part of our series of personal interviews with frontline workers, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke over Zoom with Dr. Rishi Pan, a critical care physician and trauma surgeon at Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami, Florida, about the personal and professional challenges the pandemic is posing.
We're at one of the busiest trauma centers in the country, so we're used to a busy workload. But the psychological effects have been very wearying. And coming to work is very much kind of like steeling yourself for battle. It's trying to get your head in order, trying to focus, trying to think about your team. It's almost like maybe also going through a pilot's checklist, thinking, okay, what is my plan if this happens? What is my plan if somebody with a gunshot wound to the chest comes in and spraying respiratory secretions and potentially virus all over the place, but is bleeding to death? Who am I going to send into battle, or who is going to join me in battle and put themselves at risk? And then the process of putting on our protective equipment and taking it off takes many, many minutes. Our trauma patients sometimes only have seconds to minutes to live. And so we sit outside knowing that we have the opportunity to save this patient's life, but that if we rush too fast to get on our protective equipment, we may expose ourselves. So there are very unique aspects to managing this pandemic that affects the way that we treat patients and affects the way that we interact with our team.
Give me an example of a once typical procedure that you performed that you might think about differently during the COVID era.
Well, normally when someone's heart stops in the ICU, we do CPR. What we do know is that the act of CPR is an extremely high-risk procedure for the team. What we're doing to the chest when we push on the chest to try to restart the heart, what the lungs feel is the equivalent of a cough. And a cough is how COVID is spread. So when a patient dies, it sort of boils down to trying to choose whose life I'm trying to save. And it's a very unusual position, I think, for doctors to be in these days.
Decisions like that must be so wrenching.
Extremely, absolutely. And in addition, we know that part of the heart wrench of patients who have COVID is that they're alone in the hospital. Obviously, the nurses are at the bedside, and most nurses provide excellent comfort and bedside care. The doctors, we try to be there as well as much as we can. But it's different than having a family member at the bedside holding your hand, hearing their voice, and hearing them tell you that they love you. So a lot of those patients, I'm sure, feel very, very alone, as much as we try to do to prevent that. It goes against what we've been trained to do.
It must be especially difficult when you see your colleagues come down with the COVID-19. That's not too unusual these days.
It's very hard to be really close to these colleagues and see all the things they've done and sacrifices they've made to help their patients now fall ill and be right next to their patients on life support, on a breathing machine, paralyzed. It really hurts. You think about their families or their children that you've met and that they're at home scared without their parent. And then you realize that they got sick doing the same thing that you're doing. And you're wondering, will I get sick too? Will I be next to them on a breathing machine? Will I not be able to say goodbye to my family? Will I die alone? And it's hard to keep those thoughts out of your head. Did I do something today that's going to make me infected, that's going to have me end up being a patient in the ICU?
It must be so scary and disempowering to realize that your ability to help in so many cases is so limited, at least at this point.
Absolutely. Some of us are seeing more death in a shift than we've ever seen before in our lives. And so much of what we're telling each other is that we are not failures. This is not our fault that these patients are dying, that it's the disease's fault. You know, we are doing the best we can. But in addition, we know that our ability to manage our life is being wrested away from us by something that we don't fully understand. And all of us are scared. But I think that the larger disappointment for me and for many healthcare providers is feeling failed by our governments. But the other side of that coin has been the faith that's been restored in our communities. And to see how the people around us are coming together and crowdsourcing to support each other in the vacuum that our lack of leadership has left.
Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOA. U.S. government officials are concerned that dual U.S.-Mexico citizens may flee to the United States if the coronavirus outbreak in Mexico gets worse, putting more stress on U.S. hospitals, especially near the border. The worries, which have not previously been reported, come as hospitals in the San Diego area of Southern California have pressed the Trump administration to do more to limit the threat of the virus crossing into the United States. The World Health Organization said Tuesday that some treatments appear to be limiting the severity or length of the COVID-19 disease, and that it is focusing on learning more about four or five of those promising ones. The Geneva-based World Health Organization is leading a global initiative to develop safe and effective vaccines, tests, and drugs to prevent, diagnose, and treat the novel coronavirus, which has now infected approximately 4.9 million people around the world. South Korean authorities are combing through mobile phone data, credit card statements, and CCTV footage to identify people who visited nightclubs at the center of one of the capital's biggest novel coronavirus clusters. More than 100 new cases linked to the nightclubs have brought new fears of a second wave of infections in the country, which has been held up as a coronavirus mitigation success story. Stay with VOA for all the latest U.S. and world news. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments on Tuesday via phone conference on President Donald Trump's bid to keep his taxes, bank, and financial records private after congressional committees issued subpoenas for the information. AP correspondent Shelley Adler has details.
Rulings against President Trump could lead to the campaign season release of personal financial information, including tax returns, that have been made public by every other president in recent history. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Initially, he said because of an audit was ongoing. Now it seems to be broader than that.
Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who's a Trump appointee, expressed concern about Congress abusing its authority.
How can we both protect the House's interests in obtaining information it needs to legislate, but also protect the presidency?
Two appellate courts have ruled that the documents should be turned over, but those rulings have been put on hold. I'm Shelley Antler.
Sex workers in Botswana, most of them immigrants, received food donations from charities this week after reports the majority were facing starvation due to the coronavirus lockdown. A sex workers organization behind the initiative says it aims to help at least 800 migrant sex workers during the lockdown, especially those who are HIV positive or who have young children. Kondisi Dube reports from the capital, Gaborone.
More than 800 sex workers across Botswana will benefit from food hampers donated by non-governmental organizations this week. Two NGOs working with sex workers organization Sisonke are assisting with the handouts. Sex workers who are HIV positive and those with young children will be prioritized. Program manager Mandla Bule says the project aims to help migrant sex workers who do not have access to the government's coronavirus relief aid.
Our priority groups are sex workers, especially non-citizen sex workers, because under the Botswana social relief for COVID-19, only citizens are supported with food parcels. So we saw it fit that we target sex workers who are firstly HIV positive, two, those with children, and who are foreigners.
Authorities in Botswana imposed a nationwide lockdown in March to stop the spread of the coronavirus. The country has recorded 24 cases of the virus and one death. Bule said restrictions in movement due to the lockdown have meant sex workers cannot meet their clients.
Sex workers are mostly affected because right now their work is mostly dependent on the movement of people. So under lockdown, there's no people, nobody's allowed to go anywhere. So in turn, they have lost on income.
Sex work remains illegal in Botswana, but an estimated 7,000 locals and migrants are involved in the trade. Botswana has begun easing its lockdown restrictions and full activities are expected to resume after May 21st. Mqondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone.
You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
And AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Oh. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews. Ooh. Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Ah. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. The World Meteorological Organization says many parts of the world can expect warmer than average temperatures from May through June, mainly due to human-induced climate change. The WMO has just released its global seasonal climate update. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Climate scientists expect above normal temperatures over the next 3 months, despite the absence of an El Niño, a natural phenomenon that tends to boost global temperatures. In past years, record heat has occurred in El Niño years, but that is changing. The World Meteorological Organization says that April 2020, a non-El Niño period, is tied as the warmest month on record with April 2016, when there was a strong El Niño as well as climate change. WMO spokeswoman Claire Nullis says all the years subsequent to 2016 have been very warm without El Niño, including 2019, which was the second warmest year on record. She notes the trend has continued into this year.
Global temperatures in January, February, and March were also the warmest or the second warmest year on record, according to international databases. So we're seeing now that, you know, the human influence on our climate is actually stronger. It's more powerful than, you know, natural forces of nature such as El Niño.
The WMO says most extreme weather events are happening against the backdrop of climate change. It says heat waves are increasing due to climate change, and that is having a major impact on extreme events such as tropical cyclones and heavy rainfall. East Africa, for example, is experiencing record rainfall and flooding. Nullis tells VOA that preparing for and managing the impact of extreme weather events is becoming more difficult due to COVID-19. She explains that nations are not paying enough attention to early warning systems because of the pandemic.
You know, we really do need strong multi-hazard early warning systems against hurricanes, against heat waves, because these things are all interlinked. They have a cascading effect, and COVID now is one of those hazards.
WMO scientists say the COVID-19 pandemic, more than ever before, increases the need for reliable weather forecasts and longer-term climate outlooks. They say temperatures and precipitation have a major impact on key economic and public health systems, noting that many have been brought to the brink of collapse by the pandemic. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The pandemic has kept many people quarantined at home with family and pets for weeks now, and a grassroots photography initiative called the Front Steps Project has inspired hundreds of photographers to document people in front of their homes during this extraordinary time. Matt Dibble follows one reporter connecting with neighbors in Oakland, California.
My name is Belinda. I am volunteering my time to photograph and document families during the pandemic. And how long have you guys lived here?
28 years.
Wow.
Belinda Ajamet is one of many photographers inspired to create portraits of families sheltering at home as part of an international effort called the Front Steps Project, which documents this extraordinary moment in time.
It gave me purpose, spread kindness, and I can do something that I love to do.
Okay.
With her job as a dental hygienist on hold, Belinda saw an opportunity to explore her longtime dream of being a photographer.
Don't smile.
They've been just in their own little bubble, and so to have somebody come outside and just interact with them and then bring them out.
Oh my goodness, did you see me go like that?
My day job as a hygienist requires me to read people and kind of be flexible in going with what makes them most comfortable.
Yeah.
Come here, sweetie pie.
Oh, my God. Are you kidding me right now? Oh, my God.
Everyone brings something unique with every photo, which I find really fascinating. I find people fascinating. I think the important part of this also is the documentation for their family. Children will go back, look at my great-grandma. This was during the pandemic, you know, of 2020. Look what they did.
What do you want to do?
The rainbow.
Okay, silly face. Silly face.
This pandemic has kind of slowed everyone down. The light in this whole thing is the reconnecting of the basics of humanity with each other, and that's what I like about it.
Participants receive their portraits free of charge, and in return, they're asked to donate or give back to their community in some way.
Thank you. Salam alaikum.
For VOA News, Matt Dibble, Oakland, California.
The film version of Hamilton will be released to the streaming service Disney Plus this summer. Correspondent Margie Zaraletta reports.
My name is Alexander Hamilton.
The live capture version of the Broadway show Hamilton was supposed to hit theaters in October of next year. The Walt Disney Company says it will release the movie to Disney TV Plus starting July 3rd. It will feature the original Broadway cast, including creator Lin-Manuel Miranda as Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton. Miranda says in a statement he's so proud of the show and he can't wait for people to see it. I'm Archie Zaraletta.
Billy Joel, Sting, Mariah Carey, and other stars raised more than $1 million for coronavirus relief during a telethon broadcast in New York City on Monday. Organizers say the money collected from Rise Up New York will go to Robin Hood, a charitable organization working to alleviate poverty in the city. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Mungani, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Take care of yourselves and be well.
Sing us a song, you're the piano man. Sing us a song tonight. John at the bar is a friend of mine. He gets me my drinks for free. And he's quick with a joke or to light up your smoke.
but there's some place that he'd rather be. Time for a wife, and he's talking with David, who's still in the Navy and probably will be for life.